Okay, let me move this way a little bit. Welcome, everybody. I think we're good. Today is another Wednesday webinar. Took off last week, and today is April 8th, 2026. Hope everybody had a good week. And we're still very excited about the new biology experience in June at Polyface. There's still tickets available. We're excited to meet everybody, and I actually just had Jude Roberts from the Red Pill Band was here last night, and we were working on a new song. He's working on it. I'm just giving him some ideas, called The Day the Science Died, which we may be able to roll out as the world premiere at that new biology experience. So there'll be music and dancing and some talks and good food and making a lot of new friends and meeting people. And we hope to see as many people as possible. We're also eagerly and anticipating the launch of our Circle, which is a new platform for people to communicate. And you'll be hearing more about that, and there'll be more information on the website, and you'll hear more about that as it gets closer. But we're hoping to launch early to mid-May, so stay tuned for that as another way for people to interact with us and each other. Okay, I had some science news. I always look at the feeds. I don't read many, I don't watch any news programs, zero actually, probably for 20 years, or have any, I don't subscribe to any magazines or anything like that. But when I get on the internet, there's this news feed, so sometimes I look at those just to spend a few minutes familiarizing myself with what people are saying, and I look for things that may be of interest to people. And also, people share things they're concerned about, and they ask me, what about this and what about that? So, these past couple weeks, I've heard a lot about the new COVID variant. So, let me share this here. Don't need sound, I don't think. So I saw this on a feed, what to know about the BA.3.2, the highly mutated COVID variant spreading through the world right now. And of course, this is on the hysterical Huffington Post. That was where they published this article. So let's take a look at what they know about this new mutated variant. So, it has been detected at 25 states, according to the CDC. First found in South Africa in November 2024, has spread to 23 countries. 30% of the current COVID-19 cases in certain parts of Europe. BA.3.2. According to the instructor of Division of Infectious Diseases and Geographic Medicine at the esteemed university called Stanford in California, it was detected in the wastewater across multiple states, which suggests low-level spread, but it has not yet emerged as the dominant variant, according to CDC data. So interestingly, so what they mean is they look through the wastewater, i.e. sewage, and then they do PCR and they find certain sequences, which then they use, who knows how many, what do you call it, times they run the cycles, how many cycles. And then they say, if we find a certain piece of a so-called genetic sequence that could have only come from this particular variant. The chances that that's actually the case is zero. How would you possibly know with all of the possible things that are in sewage, where that piece of RNA or DNA, in this case, probably DNA, actually came from. There is no way, and there is no way anybody proved that this variant actually exists and has a specific type of RNA that could be then translated or could be reverse engineered into DNA. So there is no way there is any specificity here. Now, here's where it gets interesting. So BA.3.3.2, a newer COVID variant, are watching because it has a large number of spike protein mutations, which may help it partially evade immunity from prior infection or vaccination, says the infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist, meaning that because they say they're the antigen that they're using in the immunization, so-called immunizations, is a part of the spike protein, then if the spike protein changes, then you will no longer be immune. And then, of course, they can show you a picture of it, of this new variant. So the changes to the spike protein make the virus more transmissible. And of course, the reason this virus is more dangerous and potentially worrisome, as he says, is not only does it have trumpets on the outside, like these medieval trumpets, which you can see here, that's a medieval trumpet, but it also has swords, unlike the usual COVID variants, which only have trumpets. So this not only has medieval trumpets, but it has little spiky swords. And so that makes it much more dangerous than the usual COVID variant. So they keep going on, but interestingly, like always, the symptoms are not actually different from what we've seen. We have upper respiratory symptoms, not pneumonia, but runny nose, sneezing, headaches, body aches. So that's the specific issues that come about with this, which are, of course, exactly the same as every other respiratory symptom. And we're going to have to see whether it causes any more severe disease. They always have to throw in the fear. And so far, there's no evidence, but of course, you never know, especially because it has the spiky things. And of course, it goes on, and that the COVID shots, may not actually work because it may have a different spike protein. So we may have to do a whole another series. But never mind, the best advice is to stay up to date on your vaccination. Good hand hygiene with toxic hand sprays. Stay home, wear masks, and if you're old, too bad. There's not much we can do for you. So stay aware, be vigilant, be afraid. That's always the go-to position, and it's apparently because of the new spiky things. Sorry about that. That's not for me. Okay, so of course, it's all a bunch of nonsense. There is no COVID-19 virus. There is no SARS-CoV-2. There's no variants. All they're doing is finding little pieces of so-called nucleotide sequences in sewage, of which they have no idea the origin or the provenance of these sequences. So it's all just the usual smoke and mirrors. So that's the COVID variant. So then I happened to run across something that I thought was just interesting to go through. Just so I'll show you this. And this was an article, Colon Cancer Cases Rise. Here's what a gastroenterologist eats. So this is from an article in USA Today. And so they are noticing, and I've seen a lot of articles about this, that cases of cancer of the colon seem to be have a pretty dramatic increase, and so they're even lowering the age that people should be screened, they say, even though they know that doesn't do any good. But at least they find more cases and they can treat you earlier so you can suffer sooner than you used to be able to. But these are often pretty severe and they have no idea why. And so they thought they would ask to see what a person who specializes only in treating diseases of the gut. So you would think that if there's any doctor who might actually care and worry and have something to say about what he or she eats, it would be a gastroenterologist, meaning somebody whose only concern is what happens in your GI tract. And there's obviously a connection between the food and your GI tract. Even doctors can see that. So we can then say, so it's a reasonable thing to say, okay, these are the experts on the GI tract. They therefore should be the experts in what a person should eat, especially a person who doesn't want to get colon cancer earlier in their life. So let's find out who this gastroenterologist is. And there's his name, Swaminath. He's a vegetarian and he already avoids meat, thanks God. But he says his job impacts how he eats. So he tries to follow the same advice he gives to patients, including staying away from high fat foods. So this is the person who's he's going to use the same advice that he gives to you, and he's going to follow it himself. You want to go towards a diet like a Mediterranean, broad-based, minimizing red meat, focusing on white meat, fish, and avoiding drinking too much alcohol. I dare say there's no traditional Mediterranean person who ever followed this particular diet. But never mind, let's call it a Mediterranean diet. He says it's never going to be perfect, but anyways, here's what he eats. Breakfast is just coffee, though he admits that's a terrible decision. But anyways, he takes his coffee with lactose-free milk. He talks later about not eating processed food. So this is obviously lactose-free, pasteurized, homogenized milk, which is probably the essence of a highly processed junk food you could possibly eat, and a quarter of a teaspoon of sugar. Of course, sugar probably to him is not a processed food. I don't know how you get white sugar without processing. But anyways, never mind. And again, what is a gastroenterologist who specializes in the gut? A colon cancer, especially under 50, is increasing. And they give all kind of reasons why. He's the chief of gastroenterology at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. It's preservatives, it's emulsifiers. There's excellent data on how these affect your gut and your immune system. So don't eat processed foods. Don't eat on a so what does he eat? Again, he ate the processed sugar and he ate the processed milk. The wor one of the worst foods you could eat is probably pasteurized, homogenized milk. So lunch is iffy. Breakfast was already iffy. He opts for coffee with an egg and toast. I'm sure it's highly processed wheat toast, a green chutney, on the weekends, bagels, which are highly processed flour, eggs and cheese. He doesn't say what kind of cheese, probably highly processed, or a breakfast burrito or hash browns if his children are demanding it. Okay, what does he eat for lunch? He goes to Sweet Green, which has non-organic lettuce and other highly sprayed vegetables, but that's filling. And if he's hungry, he may get some cashews and almonds. If he doesn't have time for lunch, He eats in the cafeteria. Dinner is dal, which is beans and some type of flatbread, I'm sure made from processed flour. And some days he has tacos or tofu or quinoa. On the weekends, he has leftovers or meals out with friends. And he has some ice cream and a small bowl only, and pizza on Friday nights. And so that's what a gastroenterologist eat. And I would say, I dare say, I can't imagine anybody who's currently listening to this who has a worse diet than this. And so I bring this up only to say, anybody who thinks that they should go to their doctor or even a gastroenterologist who specializes in treating diseases or situations of the gut and thinks that they know anything about what to eat or how to eat, all you have to do is read what this fellow eats, and you can see that none of us would eat this kind of processed food. There's no traditional Mediterranean person who ever ate this kind of diet. I don't know where they get this from. This is a highly processed, modern American, mostly junk food diet. And anybody who goes to somebody like this to get dietary advice is asking for trouble. That's all I can say about that. And one final thing, which I didn't advertise, but I'm sure many of you have been following the recent Artemis journey around the moon as they go for the first time ever to the dark side of the moon. Now, there's always a backstory. And so, one of the things they don't tell you is one of the reasons, one of the things they're looking for on this dark side or backside of the moon is for alien life, particularly intelligent alien life. And I know this hasn't been reported much, but they have actually photographic evidence of finding alien life, and I can show it to you right now. So here is the photographic evidence of finding alien life. And there it is. So you can see this is the NASA Administrator, Jarek Isaacman. And if that guy isn't an alien, I don't know who is. Unfortunately, though, it's they have reported that the alien life is not intelligent, and so they apparently have to keep looking. So at this point, they found aliens. You can see for yourself, photographic evidence, but not intelligent life. So they have to keep looking for that. Okay. That's enough of that. So I got a few questions. They're sort of interesting, a little bit unusual questions. Some of them I don't know that I can even shed much light on it, but I'll do my best. So the first one was, do children who go through so-called childhood illnesses get less chronic disease later, or are they healthier later? This is actually, I wrote two books about this. The first was the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care that I co-wrote with Sally Fallon. And then Vaccines and Autoimmunity was basically about this very subject. And obviously, since though writing those books, I've changed a lot of my thinking about what a childhood disease is or isn't. But the principles that I wrote about, I think, and observed in my practice still hold. So, what I saw, not only in my practice, but even in my own family, and this has been corroborated by a number of research articles, et cetera, on the incidence of chronic disease in people, children who have gone through what they call typical childhood diseases. So, what are those? They're talking about chicken pox and measles and mumps and German measles, whooping cough, and some others. So at the time, meaning most of my years in practice, I was actually very interested because I had literally thousands of cases over my entire career. Some years there was literally hundreds per year of, say, whooping cough. I was a lot of the people in my community, and basically, as I said, all of my patients. In fact, as I've said, I've only given somewhere between 3 and 5 tetanus shots in my entire career, and I actually apologize to all 3 to 5 of those Pete children, because I shouldn't have done that, but I did. They sort of parents wanted me to, but that's no excuse. But anyway, so I had a completely unvaccinated population, and the illnesses at the time that I was seeing, or at least thought they were specific illnesses, were whooping cough, pertussis, and chicken pox. Of course, I've since come to learn and have given many presentations that these are not actually specific diseases. There is no way to diagnose specifically whooping cough, measles, German measles, chicken pox, or any of the other ones. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so I thought they were specific diseases caused by a certain organism. I was also wrong about that, but that's what I thought. But what I was interested in is how many of the children who had whooping cough as when they were young went on to have chronic respiratory illness, particularly asthma, throughout the rest of their childhood and on into adulthood. And so that's what I was following. And again, I would say I was incorrect in thinking that whooping cough was a specific disease. Interestingly, I never did a test to specifically diagnose it. I did it based on symptoms that the ch parents reported and examining the child myself. The reason I didn't do the test for any of them, but particularly for whooping cough, is that every positive test for whooping cough was reported to the health authorities, and then the next thing that would happen is the health department would show up at the parents' house, and then there was all kinds of trouble. And so I would basically leave it up to the parents. Do you want me to do this? And 100% of them said no. And since I didn't see any benefit from making that diagnosis, we never did a test. So I never actually had a formal diagnosis. So even at the time, I didn't know how many of them actually had whooping cough or measles or German measles or chicken pox because I never did any tests because that would trigger the health department. Even though that was sort of illegal, but they didn't know I was doing that, so I got away with it. The doctors were actually specifically entrusted and ordered, I would use that word, to do these tests, but I didn't do it. And so I follow these children, and I could say, and by the way, even with whooping cough, where we were told to give them erythromycin, which is a kind of antibiotic, I don't remember ever once giving a child an antibiotic for any of those. The rest of them are so-called viral infections, so you didn't give an antibiotic. But whooping cough, you were told to give an antibiotic called erythromycin, which I don't remember ever once doing. And I had some children who got pretty sick and had a lot of respiratory distress. I don't remember anyone getting hospitalized. And nobody died, and nobody had a bad outcome. I treated them with a combination of like copper ointment or lavender oil on their chest, a couple homeopathic remedies called Pertidoron 1 and 2, and liposomal vitamin C. That was my typical whooping cough treatment, and similar for all the other different so-called childhood illnesses, except the homeopathic remedies were different in each case. And sometimes I used herbs like Bronchefect or Resco or some of the standard process Medi-Herb type herbs. So I never had a death. I never had a bad outcome. I never had anybody who was hospitalized. And the exciting thing in the reference to this question, I could say, as far as I knew, and it's possible that I lost some of the children to follow-up, none of them went on to have chronic respiratory illness like asthma. Some of them had a history of allergies or maybe even asthma in the family, but none of them who successfully went through what we called whooping cough at the time actually went on to develop chronic asthma or any other chronic respiratory disease. And it was similar with chickenpox and measles. There's no specific system that that I was watching, but very, very few of them. I had almost no patients, pediatric patients. I have to watch in case there's something going on with the sound and somebody's calling me, but that's not for me. Sorry about that. So I had almost no patients who had chronic disease, children, pediatric patients, except those who came to me with their chronic disease, having been vaccinated and treated in an abnormal way. So the children who started with me started usually with home births or very natural births, no vaccines, no vitamin K, no interventions, breastfeeding, nourishing traditions type of diet. And then in the cases where they did go through some sort of what I would call then a childhood disease, which I would call now something maybe wasn't right in their environment and they had to go through this rearrangement type process, that seemed to fix whatever the problem was. I allowed them to go through it. They all went through it successfully. I had no bad outcomes, no deaths, no hospitalizations, none of that. And none of them went on to have the chronic illness that would go along with that system that was just went through, like whooping cough had to do with the respiratory system. None of them went on to have chronic respiratory problems like asthma. Again, with the other so-called childhood diseases, there's no particular disease or system that you could watch, but I had very few children. I don't remember any child who went on to have type 1 diabetes or seizures or ADD type of diagnoses who went through all those stages, no vaccines, breastfed, home natural births, allowing them to go through their early, what I would now call sort of rearrangement situations. They weren't specific childhood diseases as I thought then, but I treated them the same as I basically would now anyway. So it didn't really matter what I called them. And so my take on it is it was a very successful approach to prevent and all of the chronic diseases that children are now so encumbered with. All you have to do is those things. And when things do go wrong and the child has to go through that, some sort of a rearrangement process, you let them go through it. You understand this is so important. You understand that this is not a life-threatening situation. I never once saw that. A confident, calm parent is the best ally that I had. When I had that, I knew we were going to be okay. You go through it, you use natural medicines, herbs, or homeopathics, or sometimes you just let it ride out on its own, and you will have a ha happy, healthy child with almost no chronic diseases. That is exactly what I saw in my practice, and there are some research studies that back that up. Okay, the second question is, what about scabies and why does it happen? Is it real? And what you should do about it? Of course, I always, whenever I think about scabies and lice and stuff, I always tell this story, which unfortunately I don't have the article this came from. I remember reading it probably almost 40 years ago. And this was one of my first introductions to thinking differently, even about these sort of large parasites. So, the first thing is lice and scabies, as far as I can see, are real in the sense that you can actually, without even a microscope or even a magnifying glass, see the little organisms crawling around on your skin and in your hair and et cetera. And I've seen them on many people myself. And I remember this study that was published in JAMA, where they took some lice and they put it in the center of a round table, and they put members of different professions sitting equidistant from the center of the table, and they let the lice essentially decide where to go. And so they had like a plumber, an electrician, and a carpenter, and a doctor, and a psychiatrist, and lawyer, and a few other people. I don't know what got how they got this idea, but apparently the lice always went to this and lived on the heads of the psychiatrist. And again, I did read that. I'm not sure it's 100% accurate, but I'm still going with it. And I remember thinking, there's nobody I can imagine who has more sort of toxic emanations from their head as your typical psychiatrist. And so that was one of my early lessons in thinking these organisms like scabies and lice, et cetera, they live on something that isn't right coming out of you. And in essentially, they're like the cleanup mop up crew. And so it's not so easy to identify what it is that's coming out of you, but it was unquestionable in dealing, as I was a school doctor for many different schools over the years, and they always have these scabies outbreaks. And it was always the same children who got scabies. Some children get it and some children don't. And it seemed to have nothing to do with like the length of their hair or the color of their hair or anything else. There was some quality which is hard to describe in the children who got scabies. And I'm not sure what that was. And basically, what we did was shave their head, and then we put some sort of neem oil, or mixed with, you can have neem mixed with garlic, and it smells terrible, but that seems to kill the scabies. And then you try to think about if there's anything in the child's life that is maybe emanating through their skin, something that you're putting on their skin, or something they're eating or exposed to emotionally, psychologically, toxicologically in their house that may be seeping out through their skin. And usually you find something, and then you can use the neem oil or the neem and garlic oil to kill the lice, and that should take care of it, or the scabies. Okay. By the way, I had one of our goats got some sort of mite problem, Charlie, and we spray him with this neem garlic oil and brushed him and gave him homeopathic remedies because he's the goat who gets picked on the most. And so it was sort of a corollary with his, you might say, his soul condition. And the combination of that, and Charlie is much better now, and his hair is growing in. And we also brushed him to stimulate his skin, and that seemed to help. But it seemed to be the combination of the neem garlic oil, actually adding more minerals to the diet. So that's another thing you could do, is add good salt and good minerals to the person's diet or the child's diet. I don't know why that makes a difference, but it seems to help balance things out in some ways. And use homeopathic or cell salt constitutional remedies for overall health of the child. And it seems to be the more you can work on the overall picture and not just scabies, because after all, the scabies or the lice or the mites, they're probably the cleanup crew eating something that shouldn't be there. So if you change what's there, they just go away and never come back. And that seemed to be the case in the children I met with this. Okay. Can COVID shots be transmitted sexually? And I think what the person means is there anything in somebody who gets a COVID shot who then has sexual contact with somebody maybe who didn't get a COVID shot, that the person who got the shot can transmit something to the person who didn't get the shot? And we've talked about this, you know, is there transmission from people who've been injected with COVID shots to the non-injected? And I think I first of all, I would admit that I don't really know the answer to this. My impression from the little reading that I've done and from observing is that there's nothing physically that can be transmitted from a COVID shot recipient to a non-shot recipient. Not by breathing, not by sweating, not by sexual contact. And so what I mean is physically, like from the shot. There's obviously things physically that you can transmit sexually. You know, there's all kinds of stuff in semen and vaginal secretions that are like physical stuff that the other person then gets in contact with. And we also know that certain drugs, like mercury-containing drugs, actually concentrate in the vaginal and semen secretions, and so you can expose somebody to mercury toxicity through sexual contact if you're taking some sort of mercury-based drug. But I don't know of anything like that in a COVID shot that would come out in the vaginal or secretions or semen that would make somebody else sick. There's also, of course, psychological and emotional interactions and communications. And I can hardly think of a more emotionally, psychologically charged contact than sexual contact. So there's always the possibility if you somebody who's convinced that you got sick as a result of sexual contact, it doesn't prove that there's anything physical that was transmitted from you to somebody else. So I think all I can say is there is the possibility of being, let's say, influenced by somebody sexually, and that's got to be the most obvious thing anybody's ever said. There is even the possibility of some physical things that are maybe transmitted, like certain drugs or mercury or something like that, may be transmitted in the sense of you come in contact with something that comes out in different bodily fluids. Of course, that is possible. I don't know anything specifically that would apply to the physical part or even the emotional part with a COVID shot. I think I would certainly look at the relationship dynamics, because there has to be a certain amount of tension if one partner got the shot and the other didn't. My guess is that's probably not the only thing they disagree on in life. And so you might want to look there, and that might be more fruitful than trying to figure out what component in a COVID shot got transmitted sexually, because I'm not sure that's the case. Okay. Somebody asked about auras without migraines. And I, again, this is something I'm not that familiar with and whether I know anything to do about this. And the best I understand this is, interestingly, one of the first examples of a disease which I started to question the specificity of was migraines. And in fact, I think it's fair to say, even in modern neurology, there used to be this elaborate classification of headaches. Like these symptoms were tension headaches, and these symptoms were migraines, and these symptoms had to do with the brain tumor, and these symptoms had to do with some other kind of headache. And I think all that has gone by the wayside, and the neurologists have admitted that there's no way they can tell what kind of headache, and these classifications are essentially meaningless. Classically, the migraines had to do with the relaxation and co first the contraction and then the relaxation of the blood vessels. So you had something that contracted the blood vessels, and then when that relaxed, you got an over relaxation, and that would create the pounding experience of a migraine headache. But I think it's fair to say nobody believes that that is a specific mechanism anymore. And these are just different experiences of headaches, maybe from different sort of toxic influences, and maybe to a certain extent having to do with the blood vessels versus the actual material of the brain. But I don't think anybody knows that. And so it really isn't worthwhile or useful to think of headaches as being specific. But when an aura is, was typically a migraine type of symptom where you would essentially experience something, like some, it could be a vision, or it could even be something you hear, or something you feel, or something that wasn't right. And then you would know that there would be a headache that would follow on after that. What this person is asking is, what if you only have the auras and you don't have a headache? And I don't think I've ever dealt with that, so I don't really know. But my only suggestion would be to try to not only sort of pay attention, but see what is it that these auras are actually trying to say to you. So the auras might be some voice that you hear, or something you see, or something you hear, or something you experience. And my guess is there's some sort of meaning, or maybe even a message, or some sort of information that's trying to be conveyed from who knows where, maybe from your some part of you that you're not really aware of. And what I would do is, the last thing you would want to do is say, no, I don't want this. In fact, I would sort of welcome it and say, to actually try to live into how interesting this must be to have this experience. I think that would not only take the fear down, which would probably alleviate the symptoms, but you might end up learning something that might be of significant value in your life. It doesn't sound like it's a life-altering sort of situation, especially if it doesn't go on to have severe headaches. So that's all I would do. The only other thing that I've seen is, a lot of times, surprisingly, people who get headaches are actually nutrient deficient, and they're eating a poor quality diet. And I've seen over and over again, even people who didn't come to me with headaches, but they came to me with their whatever blood pressure, heart, fatigue, or something, and they didn't even mention headaches. And I would put them on the best diet I could, not like that gastroenterologist, but a very really nutrient dense, with good quality meats and broth and organ foods and the best quality fermented vegetables and et cetera that they could eat, and smoothies with raw eggs and whole milk, raw kefir, etc. And often people would come back and say, "You know, what's interesting is I don't know if you were trying to treat this, but my headaches are gone." And I wasn't trying to treat it. Sometimes I didn't even know they had headaches because they didn't say it. But that seemed to work better than anything else I'd ever done, is get rid of all the processed food, all the refined food, all the simple sugars, and really stick to high nutrient dense, high quality fats, animal foods, raw milk, ferments, etc. And a lot of people's headaches just went away. Okay, a couple more. What about fungal infections, particularly ringworm? So the first thing I would do is get rid of the word infection, because there's nothing infection about this. You get fungus growing, this similar to the lice and the scabies, but now we're talking about more of a microscopic organism. You get fungus growing on your tissues, particularly your skin, when there's a whole lot of poor quality secretions coming out of your skin. And usually this involves people who eat way too much simple sugar, which the definition of too much simple sugar is any simple sugar, and poor quality food, and particularly a lot of refined carbohydrates, and are otherwise poisoned in a whole variety of ways, including using sprays and perfumes and other stuff on their skin, and also using soap on a regular, sometimes daily basis, and washing the beneficial oily layer that we typically have on our skin, and not getting enough sun. And then you'll set up the environment where the fungus need to come to essentially bioremediate the area. Essentially, you have these toxic excretions, and so particularly sweet or sugary, or yeah, sweet sugary type of secretions, and so that's not good for your skin. It clogs up your pores, etc. So the fungus come and live on it, and as soon as you stop doing that, that is a almost 100% reliable treatment for ringworm and athlete's foot and other superficial fungal infections. You clean up your diet and get rid of all the toxic products in your life that you can, and the fungal infections will almost 100% go away. I rarely had to use any sort of topical, even natural antifungal anything. I never used any systemic antifungal medicine. Those are extremely toxic drugs. I never used nystatin or fluconazole or any Diflucan, any of that stuff. Never ever prescribed that. And rarely even used any of those as creams. And I would say rarely even things like tea tree oil. You don't have to do that. You just have to have a really good diet and good hygiene and not use excessive soap and get out in the sun. And if you got it between your toes, you need to do all those things and walk barefoot and let your feet air out, and don't put your feet in, plastic shoes with synthetic socks and all that kind of stuff, and wearing synthetic clothes and you name it. All those things encourage the fungus to have to grow in a otherwise area of your body that's not well. So if you don't want the fungus, let your body breathe, all your skin breathe, your toes breathe, be out in the sun, walk barefoot, clean up your diet, and it'll go away. The final thing was, what about an EMG study or ultrasound for a person with issues with their hips or sacroiliac joint and lower back pain? So, sounding a little bit like a broken record, but I never once ordered an EMG study. I never once did an X-ray or a CT scan on any patient. With any of those problems with hips or joints or lower back pain. So the question is why? Well, one, it's been proven that, say, CT scans for lower back pain don't even differentiate between who has bad back pain and who has no back pain. There have been studies with radiologists, and half of the people have no back pain, half the people have horrible back pain. They show the CT scan to a bunch of radiologists, and they get it right about 51% of the time, which is the same as a trained monkey would do, or not even an untrained monkey, because it's yes or no, so you're bound to get around 50% right. And all it means is you can't tell, because the phenomena of pain, and even whether there's, say, impingement on a nerve, is a dynamic process which cannot actually be captured on an X-ray. The only thing you would think, well, do I need an X-ray here? Is, let's say you're thinking, this isn't your usual back pain or impingement on a nerve, but instead you have some sort of tumor growing in your spine. And I never saw that, and it does happen, but it's rare, and it's usually from somewhere else. So you already know the person has prostate cancer or breast cancer. And in that situation, it may be useful to find that out, although I probably wouldn't do it even then. But there's nothing to be gained from doing those studies. You don't get any information. These are dynamic problems of having to do with strength and movement and nutrition. You know, if you're poorly nourished, your back will be weak. If you don't move, your back will be weak. If you move in the wrong way, or if you strain your back and do movements that you shouldn't, then your back will hurt, and that will tend to put pressure on the nerves, and you'll feel numbness and tingling. A test for that adds basically nothing to what you can feel. If you don't feel numbness or tingling, you don't have a nerve impingement, you don't need to do an EMG to somehow document it. And even the argument, well, you do an EMG and you see what the nerve conduction is, and then you can do something and see if it's better. You don't need to do that because you can tell if it's better. I used to ask myself this all the time. So if I have somebody and they say, "Yeah, my back is killing me, and it's got nerve pain. I got this pain shooting down my leg," and then I do something like have them do exercises or movements and eat better and things like that, and they're better. And let's say in that situation the EMG wasn't better, who would I believe? And obviously, I would believe the person, not the EMG. In which case, what purpose did I get the EMG for? So I don't need to do that. I never did it. I don't think it adds anything to your understanding or even the management of this. You should carefully assess how you feel. You might even write it down. And again, most problems having to do with joints and back, combination of diet, food, the way you move, how you sit, how you sleep, all these dynamic things that people do that go into whether they're having pain or not. And I would also pay close attention to how you sit, how long you sit, when you move, and things like that. Okay, thanks everybody for listening, and hope you have a good week, and I will see you next week.